Well, thank you very much for your welcome, and I would like to start by thanking the organizers very warmly for this opportunity to share a few thoughts with you this afternoon. And it's been a great experience for me to listen to many different lectures over the past 24 hours. And I want to thank the organizers especially for letting a natural scientist into this discussion, which is so heavily full of people experienced in Aquinas and in philosophy and theology. So I come to you as a natural scientist and not as a philosopher at all. And indeed, I think it will be fairly hard for me to find new things to say this afternoon, but hopefully some of the things I say will give a slightly different perspective on our discussion. Some of it will be repeating some of the themes that we've been hearing about already. I'd like to thank Justin Chambrier in particular for opening up the discussion at the beginning of yesterday, his talk on biblical miracles, because also I will be touching on that topic as well. Now, I knew that as I pressed the button on this changer, this is the first challenge to science, it's not actually changing. So what does that mean? I thought we might have that slight problem. I am pressing the arrow, but I'll give it to a philosopher who will be able to do it, you know, much better than a scientist, I know.
I'm actually a physicist. I only pretend to be a philosopher.
A physicist. I'll tell you a story. I was once at giving a talk some years ago in Oxford University, and there were three full professors of physics in the audience, and the technical side of things didn't work, okay? And each one of the professors came up to try and fix, you know, the PowerPoint. They could not fix it, three professors. And then a PhD student came up and fixed it in 5 seconds. So. And it's always the same story. If you want to fix things technically these days, go for a younger person. It's always a good idea. Okay, so can a scientist believe in miracles? I could say just yes and walk away, but I won't do that. And so I will try and do that way. Actually, if you lived at any time around 1900, then the question, can a scientist believe in miracles, I think would have seemed very strange. For, as you know, virtually all the European natural philosophers of the early modern period were those who believed in miracles, and they accepted the biblical miracles as real historical events. Having said that, I mean, there was considerable variation amongst the natural philosophers as to whether miracles still happen today. They were not in agreement on that point. But the Royal Society in my own country was founded in 1660 by Christian natural philosophers. I think it was almost founded like a Christian mission in many ways when you read their writings. And so the Royal Society's motto, Nullus in Verba, is usually translated as take nobody's work for it. And so it's an expression, a determination of fellows to withstand the domination of authority and to verify all statements by an appeal to facts determined by experience. Now, the Royal Society's history was already published by the Anglican Bishop Thomas Spratt in 1667. I always think that publishing the history of a new society only 7 years after its founding is a bit of a hurry. But of course, you know, the life expectancy in the 17th century was a lot shorter than today. Maybe that had some influence on his decision. But clearly Bishop Spratt was reflecting the views of the fellows when he wrote about the miracles performed by Christ, writing, and I quote from Spratt, "And these miracles with which he asserted the truths that he taught, if I might be allowed this boldness in a matter so sacred, I would even venture to call his Godhead," close quote. In other words, Christ's miracles were experiments that confirmed his doctrinal assertions. But we have to remember that experiments in the science of the time were seen rather differently to the way we think about them today. Experiments were seen as demonstrations of the properties of the world around us. And so Spratt is seeing a direct parallel here between the practical demonstrations of the fellows of the Royal Society to support their scientific ideas and the demonstrations or miracles performed by Christ in support of his divinity. But we should also note that the Anglicans of this time were mostly cessationists. They believed the miracles no longer occurred after the completion of the New Testament era. But the natural philosophers of the time nearly all believed in miracles. And one of the key founders of the Royal Society at that time, the founders also one of the founders of modern chemistry, Robert Boyle, referred, and I quote from Boyle, to the clear and convincing proofs by miracles of the Christian faith that he found in the New Testament. Likewise, Isaac Newton certainly believed in the historic miracles described in the Bible. As you may know, Newton wrote far more about the Bible than he ever did about his science. He wrote about 2.5 million words or more in Latin about his study of the Bible. Some of it a bit strange, it has to be said, but he was a great Bible student. But I think in both cases of Newton and Boyle and others, there was a kind of skepticism about contemporary claims for the miraculous. And I think here we also see the Anglican cessationism having an influence on the thinkers of that time. Now, overall, the belief in the biblical miracles by these early Christian natural philosophers is of interest, I think, because it shows that one of the criticisms made by contemporary scientists against the possibility of miracles is fallacious. Surely, say some contemporary scientists, if we believe in miracles, then it opens the door to believing all kinds of weird things, and so rigorous science becomes very difficult. And this point was made in an editorial in the top science journal Nature back in 1984, and the editorial was responding to a letter written to the Times newspaper in London defending belief in the biblical miracles. The letter had been written by 6 fellows of the Royal Society and 8 university professors of science, led by the late Sam Berry, professor of genetics at London University. And by way of response, the Nature editorial is headlined, "Miracles Do Not Happen," and finishes with a comment that the trouble with the publication from Berry et al. Is that it provides a license not merely for religious belief, which on other grounds is unexceptionable, but for mischievous reports of all things paranormal, from ghosts to flying saucers, close quote. Because the editorial misses the historical point that, as we've been saying, the founders of modern science nearly all believed in the biblical miracles. But at the same time, it was precisely because they believed in the Creator God who brings order out of disorder that they established the idea of the laws of nature. And their belief in the God of order made them naturally skeptical of weird and wonderful things happening in their own day. So the criticism of the Nature editorial is contradicted by an experiment already done in the history and philosophy of science. And of course, as we track down the natural philosophers who then became called scientists from mid-19th century onwards, if we track them down from the 16th and 17th centuries right up to the present day, we can find plenty of scientists who had and have in the present belief in the biblical miracles. Here's on the screen 2 notable examples from the 19th century. If you like, the co-discoverers of electromagnetism, Michael Faraday, after whom we named our Faraday Institute for Science and Religion in Cambridge, and then, of course, James Clerk Maxwell, who put electromagnetism into mathematics, and whose equations are still taught in physics courses to the present day. Both passionate Christians, both passionate believers in the miracles of the Bible. Then we get to the present day, when, of course, we have a more secular climate. We find Richard Dawkins from my own country asserting that any belief in miracles is flat contradictory, not just to the facts of science, but to the spirit of science, close quote. And I suspect that most of my scientific colleagues in the scientific community kind of think about miracles the way that Wikipedia does, or did until recently. They've changed the wording now, but Wikipedia says that a miracle can be defined as a violation of natural law by a supernatural being, which is also a definition which has been used by some of our speakers over the past 24 hours. So whether it's Nature editorials or scientists like Richard Dawkins or the popular voice of Wikipedia, I think there's unity of opinion amongst the majority of secular scientists today that miracles are simply impossible events that simply don't happen. And we've already been thinking a lot in the past, again, 24 hours, about David Hume. And of course, he was a Scottish philosopher who wrote a very powerful little essay on miracles. And it's interesting, I think, when you look at Richard Dawkins, when you look at Wikipedia, when you look at popular thought about miracles in the scientific community, I think you can basically bring it back to David Hume. David Hume has been the most influential philosopher in contributing to this discussion for good or for ill. And you remember how we've already been hearing his influential essay on miracles is just 20 pages tucked away in his Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding, 1748. I often think it's a good example of how a very short essay, a very short article can have a very big influence. So I'm afraid some of us think the longer we write, you know, the bigger influence it will have. But no, actually, if you look at the history of science and philosophy, often it's the very short, pithy, concrete little articles that have a very big influence. Of course, the so-called deist thinkers exerted a strong influence during the 18th century. And so Hume is writing against this particular background. And as you know, deists promoted this rationalistic belief in God, but they resisted the idea of a God who was active in human lives and who answered prayer. And so they were particularly resistant to the idea of a God who did miracles. And so really, I think what this essay is doing by David Hume, he's really summarizing the arguments of the deists. His first part summarizes his a priori arguments for the impossibility of miracles, referring to those arguments which Hume thought ruled miracles out of court as a matter of principle. Hume's opening gambit is to underline the point that experience is our only guide in reasoning concerning matters of fact. However, experience is not an infallible guide, as nature is not always predictable, and neither do we know all the possible range of natural causes. Therefore, says Hume, a wise man proportions his belief to the evidence. The observer should balance the type of evidence which is available to them and establish a kind of certainty-uncertainty scale in which beliefs will vary in their position on the scale depending on the available data. Well, so far so good. I think these are all good, valid points to make. But then, as we've been thinking also by two other speakers, Hume goes on to claim that if our experience of something is completely consistent, if in the whole of our lives we have invariably observed that same conjunction of events, A always goes along with B, then if someone claims something different, then we shouldn't believe it, however strong the evidence. And so we have a quote here, which we've already heard, those of us who've been here over the whole conference. I think we've heard this many times before, this summary of Hume's his conclusions: a miracle is a violation of the laws of nature, and as a firm and unalterable experience has established his laws, the proof against a miracle from the very nature of the fact is as entire as any argument from experience can possibly be imagined. Close quote. Here again, Wikipedia, and here again, Richard Dawkins. So nothing new under the sun. And so in his essay, Hume tries to establish that in principle, no testimony under any circumstances would be sufficient to establish the veracity of any miraculous event. Natural laws are built on uniformity of experience, and miracles are alleged violations of natural laws. Therefore, they don't happen. But note, as we've already been hearing during this conference, for Hume, laws of nature were something on which our own experience had established a regularity of concurrence between events to such a high degree of probability, or such a high degree of our own experience, that not a single occasion had ever been observed when this concurrence was lacking. And of course, this is very different, as we know, from the idea of laws of nature introduced by the 17th century natural philosophers, such as Descartes, Isaac Newton, Boyle, you find springing up this the theological roots of the ideas of laws of nature very much in that 17th century literature. Here we've got the laws of nature rooted in the will of God as the creator and law-giving. So part two of Hume's essay is what's called the a posteriori, arguments those that depend on assessment of evidence after it has already been presented. So the arguments that Hume collects in part two would have been familiar, I think, to anyone of that era who had followed along with the deistic debate of the previous century. I mean, there's really no hint of novelty here. He's simply summarizing what you can find many times in the writings of others. And here Hume is presenting four arguments. First, witnesses to alleged miracles are all incompetent, or they're suffering from delusions, or are not beyond suspicion in some other way, so we cannot really trust them. Second, people love gossip, and so there is an innate human tendency to pass on stories which become exaggerated in the telling. Third, says Hume, miracles are observed chiefly to abound among ignorant and barbarous nations. I'm quoting here from Hume's own words. So they were not often observed amongst educated people, so rendering them intrinsically unlikely. And here Hume illustrates his deeply racist attitudes towards foreign nations, an attitude which I have to say comes out many times in his writings. He was a man of his time, but his racist comments, I think, are much more frequent than even those of his writers at the time. And then his fourth point, says Hume, rival religions claim miracles which oppose each other, and so they in effect cancel each other out. And then Hume goes on to say in his little essay, he gives a number of historical or contemporary examples of miracles, including those stories well known at the time he was writing of the alleged miracles of healing connected with the tomb of the Jansenist deacon François de Paris over there in France. As Hume freely admits, the evidence for such healings having occurred was really rather strong. So his conclusions, I think, on the matter are therefore quite informative. He writes, and I quote, "Where shall we find such a number of circumstances agreeing to the corroboration of one fact? And what have we to oppose to such a cloud of witnesses but the absolute impossibility or miraculous nature of the events which they relate? And this surely, in the eyes of all reasonable people, will alone be regarded as a sufficient refutation." So we see here Hume's particular definition of rationalism. In other words, what he's saying here, since miracles cannot happen, even though the witnesses are both vocal and numerous, nevertheless, their combined testimony cannot possibly accumulate to provide sufficient weight to believe that miracles have occurred. So let's just accept Hume's definition of a miracle for a moment from the first part of his essay and note the three main critiques that philosophers have mounted against it, some of which, of course, have already been mentioned, particularly by Professor Bonifacque in his excellent talk yesterday. First of all, the first critique, of course, is that the argument is circular. It's a question-begging argument. For if a miracle is a violation of the laws of nature, which have in turn been established by unalterable experience, then clearly there can be, by prior definition, no experience that anyone could have which would change such a conclusion. And speaking now as a scientist, I would say, unfortunately, Hume's argument leads to a closed mind when it comes to considering the evidence rather than the kind of mind which is open to evidence. As you know, scientists are meant to be empiricists and not dogmatists, and that makes a big difference in the scientific community. Second, Hume's idea that a large accumulation of uniform human experience adds up to such a quantitative weight that no counter evidence can possibly overthrow it is not really a very useful one. Even though no one has until now reliably detected evidence for intelligent life elsewhere, a single, unambiguous and intelligible message from outer space would establish the existence of intelligent life forms elsewhere in the universe. So science thrives on exceptions. Conformity to previous experience is boring. If you're a scientist and you want to make an important discovery, then you look for the exceptions. In my lab, I'm always encouraging my PhD students to look for the exceptions. Unfortunately, they usually, because they didn't know the experiment very well, but experiments, exceptions are really important in science. In 1610, it was universally and very frequently observed regularity of nature that all astronomical bodies orbited the Earth. So, according to Hume's argument, the rational reaction on hearing reports that there were moons orbiting Jupiter would be to dismiss the reports. On the argument, it's more likely for the observer to have been mistaken than for the well-established regularity of nature to be broken. And as you'll know, if you've done a little philosophy of science here, the philosopher Karl Popper was famous for making potential falsifiability a key criterion for a valid scientific theory. As Popper pointed out, however many times you observe something, for example, observing billions and millions of white swans and concluding that all swans are white, a subsequent observation of a single black swan will bring your theory crashing to the ground. And so scientific theories should, in principle, be falsifiable. A lot of discussion about that in the philosophy of science, but in my own area of the biomedical sciences, it's still a very true, valid aspect of the way that we do our science. But Hume also failed to realize that the wise and intelligent person bases his or her beliefs on evidence rather than possibility. Evidence is weighed, not added. Evidence for repeatable phenomenon is not necessarily greater than for events which have happened only once. Depends what it is. And the third critique of Hume is that he was in a particularly weak position to argue that miracles are impossible because they violate the laws of nature, since for Hume, laws implied no necessity. His idea of laws was based on the uniformity of repeated observations. Swans are always white. Hume could have accepted the 17th century Christian understanding of laws put forward by Descartes, Boyle, and Newton, but he chose not to. Now, of course, the irony is that nearly all scientists today hold more to the 17th century Christian view than to Hume's understanding, believing that the laws of nature are indeed very deeply rooted in the consistency of the properties of matter. But I think today scientists very often forget the theological roots of the idea of the laws of nature. Why are the properties of matter so consistent? Because sustained that way by the all-powerful creator. The late Stephen Hawking, who self-identified as an atheist, was well within this tradition when he observed that it would be, and I quote from Hawking, it would be completely consistent with all we know to say that there was a being who is responsible for the laws of physics. By the way, Hawking surrounded himself with Christians. All his closest friends, many of whom I know, were committed Christians. And that's another point, okay? But interesting observation. What I find interesting in looking at the beliefs of those contemporary scientists that do believe in the biblical miracles, and there are many of them, is that they have largely rejected Hume's definition of miracles as being events that break natural laws, and have instead, I think, adopted the Bible's understanding of miracles, which I think is really actually rather different. Excuse me. I think it's worth reminding ourselves about some of the words used for miracles in the biblical text. We've already meditated quite a bit on biblical miracles in the past 24 hours, but I think it's useful to look at the actual words that are used. So the Greek word teras, its Hebrew equivalent mopheth, translated usually in English as wonders, they're used to draw attention to events which are so remarkable that they are remembered. The term here focuses more on the amazement produced in the witnesses of the event rather than on the specific purpose of the event. And then we have the Greek word dunamis, from which we derive our word in English dynamite, translated as acts of power, mighty works, emphasizes the biblical conception of miracles as a result of the operation of the dunamis of God, the power of God, who is perceived to be the source of all power. And so whereas Taras points to the impact the miracle made on the observer, dunamis points more to its cause. And then I think the third word, which we've again meditated on much during this conference, the third word is really most critical of all in understanding how the Bible views science is sign, ot in Hebrew or semion in Greek, hence of course semiotics. For example, after crossing the Red Sea, there we have it in this sort of Sea of Reeds, as probably is the best translation there. Moses told the people that with your own eyes, you saw those great trials, those miraculous signs and great wonders. Those signs and wonders rooted there in those wonderful miracles of Exodus. And then again, we see sign all over the place in the Gospels, but especially in the Gospel of John, as he uses Simeon to describe the miracles of Jesus. Again, as we've been thinking many times in the past 24 hours, miracles are only meaningful in a particular context as they point to something beyond the event itself. Simeon emphasizes the purpose of the miracle. The intention of a Simeon is to reveal aspects of God's character, especially his power and his love. As Peter proclaims on the day of Pentecost, Jesus of Nazareth was a man accredited by God to you by dunamis, by miracles, by wonders, by teras, and by signs, Simeon, which God did among you through him, as you yourselves know. I think it's fascinating there in that first preaching on the day of Pentecost, we have all three words in Greek rolled together in one sermon. Now, the words teras, dunamis, and Simeon are not the only words used by the New Testament to refer to the miraculous, but I think, you know, they are the most commonly used. And as I said, are frequently mentioned together in the same breath. I think it's quite remarkable that the word teras, wonder, is always combined with one or the other, or indeed both together. So I think it emphasizes the reluctance of the biblical text to dwell on the merely marvelous character of the miracles. Yes, they were marvelous, they were amazing, they aroused wonder, but they were always tied together with the semion, the meaning, the internal, what was going on? What is the sign here which is happening? And so in the Bible, as we've been thinking a lot, is the context and purpose of the miracle which draws most attention. And here I want to give my own definition of miracles, which is a nice simple one compared to others. And I think it's quite in keeping with a number of the definitions we've had. But my own simple definition of miracle is a sign of God's special grace in a particular historical religious context. Simple, but I think it encompasses a lot of what we read about with the biblical miracles. And of course, immediately we go in that direction, we immediately get a stark contrast with Hume's understanding of miracles as isolated anomalies which somehow violate the laws of nature. Biblical miracles are made plausible by their coherence, by the way they fit into an overall theistic picture or narrative. And if we accept this definition of a biblical miracle, then conceptually, they only happen within a theistic worldview. And so I would want to suggest that within the biblical framework, as we've been thinking, a miracle may or may not involve an unusual change in the physical properties of the world around us. But for the scientist who believes in the traditional doctrine of creation, this really makes no difference. We've had many quotes from Aquinas for understandable reasons in the past 24 hours, so I thought it might be good to quote here from Augustine, who expressed the point in his literal commentary on Genesis, really a number of versions of it written over the period 405 to 415 AD. And there in his literal commentary in the context of his speaking about miracles, Augustine writes that when such a thing happens, it appears to us as an event contrary to nature. But with God, it is not so. For him, nature is what he does or what he has done. And the philosopher Leibniz, I think, makes this point in his famous correspondence with Isaac Newton, when he commented that when God does miracles, he does not do it in order to supply the wants of nature, but those of grace. I think it's also interesting to read the sermon of John Donne, who was Dean of St. Paul's Cathedral in London. He gave this sermon on March the 25th, 1627. And I quote here from John Donne. He writes, "There is nothing that God hath established in a constant course of nature, which therefore is done every day, but would seem a miracle, and exercise our admiration if it were done but once. Nay, the ordinary things in nature would be greater miracles than the extraordinary, which we admire most, if they were done but once, and only the daily doing takes off the admiration." Now, I've summarized, if you had the handout, I think it came around, the four types of miracles recorded in the Bible. We've seen various typologies or categories, ways of systematically organizing the miracles in the Bible. I think they're all fine. The one I've given you there, I just, being a scientist, I have to number them C1 to C4. But for type C1, context and timing provides the key to their miraculous nature. And already Justin Schemper has highlighted this one for us. And of course, the classic example here is some of the miracles of the Exodus. We'll be hearing about the bitter lake made sweet. Another classic example is the people of Israel crossing the Sea of Reeds. And it is the Sea of Reeds in Hebrew, Yom Sup in Hebrew, as they escape from Egypt. And of course, this one I think is very interesting because in the text in Exodus chapter 14, as it describes the event, the Israelites are praying desperately for a way of escape. And we read that Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and all that night the Lord drove the sea back with a strong east wind and turned it into dry land. The waters were divided, and the Israelites went through the sea on dry ground. That is quote. And so the text itself describes how the miracle happened. I mean, this has nothing to do with the breaking of the laws of nature. This is rather a miracle of timing. This is a sign of God's grace in a particular historical context. And if you want more details about how that miracle may have taken place, with a lot of geographical and geological detail as well, then I'd recommend this book by Sir Colin Humphreys, who was until recently Professor of Material Science in Cambridge, but he's now at Queen Mary College in London. And he's written a book on this whole topic called The Miracles of Exodus. It's really a fascinating account. And Professor Humphreys locates the crossing of the Sea of Reeds at the head of the Gulf of Aqaba, at the top end of the Red Sea, for many different reasons, which you'll have to read the book to find out. We don't have time to get into the detail here. Just worth pointing out, though, that his point is there are good reasons why the people of that time would have called the Red Sea the Red Sea. There are also good reasons why they would have called it the Sea of Reeds as well, Yom Sup in Hebrew. And he just says both are true, and it just reflects the historical nature of the accounts that they were picking up on the usage of both terms used for the Red Sea at that time. The point here, of course, is, as I say, the miracle is one of timing. It clearly parts company with David's Hume's comment that, and I quote from Hume again, "Nothing is esteemed a miracle if it ever happens in the common course of nature." Well, there's a miracle in the Exodus which doesn't fit with the definition of David Hume. Now, for this example of a biblical miracle, clearly it should not be thought by scientists or anybody else that all those biblical miracles have potentiality for some sort of scientific description. And we know that's clearly not the case. And at the other extreme, I've put the category of C3 and C4 in the handout. First recorded miracle, changing water into wine. That doesn't happen now, or it doesn't happen in the first century and doesn't happen in the 21st century. That's the whole point. So science hasn't added anything to that discussion at all. They knew that in the first century as well as we do know that now. So that's what makes it extraordinary. That's what makes it a taras. That's what makes us seek the semion, the sign of what's going on here in that first miracle. And so really, as I say, the emergence of modern science hasn't added anything at all to the point of whether or not these biblical miracles in the category C3 and C4 actually took place. The whole point is they are semions. They, in this case, the water into wine, provide this very powerful sign of the new covenant and the water now becoming blood and the new covenant being inaugurated by the teaching and preaching of Jesus of Nazareth. If we come on to the resurrection of Jesus from the dead, again, absolutely central to Christian faith, by far the most important miracle recorded for us in the Bible, clearly totally different from, you know, the east wind blowing a light and the sea of reeds and so on. This is something just dramatic and a singularity, as it's often called. People just don't rise from the dead. We don't know that any more than people knew that didn't happen in the first century. In fact, of course, they were better placed to know that didn't happen because in the Middle East at the time and to the present day, you handle the dead body yourself. You do the embalmment as they did in the Gospels. They knew what a dead body was. And so clearly here the semion, the sign, becomes most powerful of all, illustrating the theological significance of this great physical reality. Clearly, the empty tomb only becomes a powerful sign in this particular historical context. I mean, there were many empty tombs in Jerusalem at that time. It was this particular empty tomb that made all the difference. So it's difficult to see how science itself, per se, can be anything other than agnostic when considering such miraculous claims. I mean, science is particularly good at investigating phenomena which are potentially reproducible and which can be investigated under controlled experimental conditions. And science is also quite able to build up a picture of historical chains of events to explain the present properties of the physical world, be it in geology or evolutionary biology. Since the present status of rocks and animals provide the primary data from which the historical investigation can be launched. However, when the claim is of a unique and unusual historical event, then science simply has no investigatory tools to be useful in such circumstances, any more than science is of much use when investigating any other historical event, which depends entirely on written eyewitness reports. In fact, I think it's possible to place the C1 to C4 miracles on a kind of spectrum, stretching at one end from those for which the Bible itself provides causal explanations, like the crossing of the Red Sea, or the Israelites crossing the Jordan into the Promised Land would be another example. And then we can go from those, the C1 category, right through to the other end of the spectrum of Jesus rising from the dead. And clearly on the C3 and C4, these are not things which certainly the kind of science we know of at the present could not, in principle, attempt any kind of explanation. But then in the middle, those in C2 perhaps more, you have various miracles of healing. Well, possibly some sort of scientific description or understanding might be possible, psychosomatic and so forth. But the point is that in terms of the biblical text, this whole range are considered to be teras, they're considered to be miracles. And so their designation as a miracle is not based on their law-defined properties, but on the way in which they stand out as focused and particular instances of God's will expressed in a way made unusual by the timing or by its rareness or maybe by its uniqueness as a phenomenon. So the question then is, and with this I'll sort of come to the second to last point, why is it then that so many contemporary scientists accept the biblical miracles? I personally think it's because their understanding of miracles is very different from that of David Hume and also from Richard Dawkins' similar understanding, which I think, as I say, continues to dominate the culture of the scientific community. So let me just highlight four of those differences. First of all, miracles are all set within this matrix of belief in God as the creator and sustainer of all that exists. And that worldview is clearly going to change our attitude towards the feasibility of miraculous claims, be they miracles of timing or miracles that entail changes in the physical structure of the world. If there is a creator God who upholds all that exists, then we may not be totally surprised if he chooses to do things differently on rare occasions. I think it's perfectly reasonable to believe in the biblical miracles if we are operating within this theistic matrix. Secondly, as we've been emphasizing, and as many others have, is the meaning of the miracles. That's the key. Miracles as signs of God's grace in particular historical circumstances. These are no random anomalous events without current explanation, which is pretty much how Richard Dawkins thinks of miracles, but they have particular meanings in particular contexts. Third, the biblical miracles lie beyond science. As I say, science is great at investigating reproducible phenomena, but the miracles, the biblical miracles, are unique historical events. And science is simply not much good at investigating such events. Instead, you need historians who in turn depend on eyewitnesses. All of history, if you think about it really, is about the study of unique events. No historical event is exactly the same as another. It might be similar. And so it's always the evidence that counts. And as we were thinking yesterday, that's why the New Testament makes so much of the evidence of many people of the risen Christ, 500 of them at once on one occasion. And so what science and history do have in common, I suppose, is their commitment to the importance of evidence. And then fourth difference from Hume's understanding of miracles is that in some cases, in the historical context, the reported miracle was in principle falsifiable in its context. And I find it really fascinating that the Apostle Paul displays this kind of way of thinking in his writing in 1 Corinthians 15, which we were also thinking about yesterday, in a way that's quite similar in some ways to Karl Popper in the philosophy of science. As you remember, Paul is writing to the church in Corinth. It's only 21 years after the resurrection, thereabouts. And he's writing to them about what happens when you die, saying that if the resurrection of Christ happened, then Christian faith is a waste of time. It's futile. If Christ has not been raised, our preaching is useless, and so is your faith, writes Paul. If the dead are not raised, let us eat, drink, for tomorrow we die. Of course, the whole point here is that was a really risky thing, wasn't it, for Paul to say. After all, he was living at the time when many of the disciples of Jesus were still alive. His brothers were still alive. Had the body, embalmed body, been discovered in a tomb in Jerusalem, then Paul's whole faith, his whole worldview, his whole life would have collapsed in a single instance of counter-refutation. False viability is very powerful. So I find that very powerful, actually, when people are thinking about the evidence of resurrection. To me as a scientist, to enter into the thinking of those people like Paul who were passionate about the resurrected Christ, that is a very powerful bit of evidence, that he's laying his life down to, you know, something that could have been falsified so easily. The body could have been found and produced and recognized. So I think some of these reflections, anyway, help to explain, I think, why many scientists today do believe the biblical miracles. I'm thinking of leading natural scientists here. Francis Collins was head of the Human Genome Project, then director of the U.S. National Institute of Health for many years, very vocal about his faith, very public about his Christian faith, clearly somebody who believes in the biblical miracles. And I could give hundreds of other examples of people from the scientific community. But lastly, that still does leave us with a question as to whether scientists can still believe in miracles today. Going back to Anglicanism of the 17th century, what about cessationism? Here I think we can find more diversity of opinion. But if a miracle is a sign of God's special grace in a particular historical context, then personally I can see no reason why not, especially if we remove Hume's definition of a miracle and replace it with a more biblical understanding. Cessationists, it seems to me, seem to be trying to tell God what he should or should not do. This looks to me like hubris. I want to just take, in closing, one recent example from my own experience. A few weeks ago, some Christian friends of mine in a country not very far from here were seeking to help some other Christians with their small baby's serious, very serious illness. In desperation, they finally took their baby to Switzerland to receive specialist treatment. But the doctors eventually told the parents that they had done all they could, but sadly their baby was going to die, so they should get themselves ready for some sad news. Meanwhile, our friends in a country not very far from here were praying fervently that the baby might be healed. And of course, the Christian parents of the baby were praying the same. And then a few days later, after the parents had actually returned to their country and leaving their baby with the doctors there in Switzerland, after they'd heard this very gloomy news, the Swiss specialist then called them up and said, very remarkably, and they couldn't understand what was going on, but the baby had recovered completely, and they had no explanation for it. In fact, said the Swiss doctors, it seemed to them like a miracle. That was the terminology used by the Swiss doctors, not by the parents of the baby. So what do we need to make of such events? Well, clearly, I think this is a sign of God's special grace in a particular historical context. So I personally have no problem with calling it a miracle. But does that mean there could, in principle, be no medical explanation for this sudden healing? Well, I don't see why not. Let's say we had a super scientist, a super medic who comes along, who can see everything that's going on. Maybe if that super scientist had 100% access to the baby's complete physiology moment by moment, then it might be possible to give a detailed physiological explanation of what had taken place. Personally, in my own view of miracles, for me, that would not change the miraculous nature of the event one little bit. The east wind blew all night, and the waters were parted. If you like, the east wind, people were praying, and the baby was healed, the baby was saved. And so it's the loving, prayerful context of the Christian parents and their Christian friends, the particular historical context that brings the miracle to pass. So there's just a few reflections on cessationism. So maybe I could close by quoting Augustine once more, a comment very relevant to the question, can scientists believe in miracles? As Augustine wrote, no one believes anything unless he previously knows it to be believable. And I will close now by welcoming you to Cambridge. Anyone who wants to come to the Faraday Summer School there, the Art and Science of Human Health and Spirituality, first week of July, be very welcome to come and enjoy life in Cambridge this summer. Thank you very much for your attention. Thank you.